Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. My name is Pip Adam. I'm really grateful to be here. We are right in the eye of a cyclone. Wellington has got off relatively easily. My heart goes out to everybody over the country. Terrible, dangerous, horrible weather this week. So, sending lots of love and nothing probably I can do from here will help, but all the best. This is episode 13 in a series that I'm doing called Beyond a Joke. It is a series where I talk to intelligent people, intelligent and creative people, about things that have made them laugh. It occurred to me today when I was writing episode 13 of Beyond a Joke that I have no idea how long this series will go on. I'm still enjoying it though, so I guess one more week is the answer to that, at least one more week. I get to talk to Amon Mara in this episode. Amon is an incredible writer, an incredible sort of observer and documenter, and makes work in all sorts of different places using all sorts of different forms, and continues to say some of the most interesting things about the world through that work. Amon was one of the people who agreed to be part of the Verb After Hours event that I got to put together for Verb Festival last year. Very grateful for that, very grateful for the opportunity. And that's really what we talk about here. Well, that's where we start. In this episode, the next thing you'll hear will be that performance. It's taken from a recording from the desk, so it's a little bit, but you get the idea. Then Amon and I will talk about that performance, and then very quickly the episode just lifts up. The conversation just lifts into all sorts of areas I just could not have hoped for, and it's truly one of the most sort of poignant and interesting conversations I've had. Probably ever. So we sort of start talking about this performance, as I said, and then we very quickly start to sort of talk about ideas of audience and ideas of AI interrupted choosing for us, algorithms, and then we talk a little bit about choosing slowness and what that might look like. Amon has started an amazing project, which we talk about in here, where Amon's going to talk about every record that they own. So it's called Every Record I Own. It's an amazing sort of blog series of writing, just talking about incredible work through an incredible mind and an incredible observation. We almost finished, we're almost coming to a landing. I'm like, oh yes, this is almost over. And then Amon starts talking about an artist who Amon's known about and championed for a long time, but is relatively new to me and I have just fallen completely for. We talk about Maxine Funke, and I've put a video of Room in the City on the what do you call that? Newsletter. So you can listen to it there. One of the cool things about procrastinating, which is and sort of being busy, is that this podcast will now come out just after the third anniversary of the publication of Amon's amazing book, 2,000 Feet Above Worry Level. It's an incredible book. I've put a link to it in the newsletter, but you can seek it out anywhere. It really is just one of the most astounding pieces of writing written in New Zealand. It's amazing. Highly recommend it. So here's the conversation. There you go. I really don't know what else to say except thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing to the newsletter. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much to the people who contribute financially. I like to pay people that come on the podcast as guests, and your financial contributions help me to do that. But please remember that you do not have to pay for any of this. If you're able to pay, I'm very grateful. If you're not, please just subscribe. We love having, or I do, I always say we, it's only me, I'm sitting in my bedroom. I'm extremely grateful to know, just to have an audience to sort of make this for. And thank you so much. And take care, everybody. Don't go anywhere if you don't have to. And hopefully next time I see you, things will be looking brighter. Thanks heaps.
Next up, we have Amo Mara. Yay!
Great, thank you. I've brought a blank piece of... There's a picture on the other side of this piece of paper, which is what I've brought, but I'm holding it this way for a reason, which is that I'm going to show it to you later. But before I do, we need to get some sort of theoretical framework off the ground, make sure we all have a shared understanding of why this is funny. And for that, you really need to understand a film theory idea called mise-en-scene, which if any of you have studied film theory, it's the very first thing you learn. And that is what I learnt in the week that I studied film at university. And when I was like, oh, have I got this concept right? I'll Google it before I do this. And apparently it means anything you want, if you want to sound fancy when talking about film. But the way I'm thinking of it is like, it's kind of about everything that's in the shot and everything that, like the placement of everything and how that contributes to the art as a whole, which this does really well. It's here. But even though this is quite a big piece of paper for a piece of paper, it probably isn't visible to everyone at the back. So what I have also done is put this picture as the front page of my website. So I thought before I turn it around, what I'll get everyone to do is to go to my website, but not press OK yet, so we all get it at the same time. But my name is also not the easiest to spell, so I'm going to spell it out to you now while you do that, because otherwise some people may go to a different website or probably get a... There is no website, but so my name is Amon Mara, spelt EAMONNMARRA.com, which is just the website part of it. That's not part of my name usually. But, all right, so I'm going to show this to you now. I took this photo a couple of years ago at a bottle store in Newtown. It's a table at the bottle store with a carafe of water with a Tui coaster on top, next to a sign that says free glass of water available, and then way down at the other end of the table is one single empty glass. And if you look in the carafe, there is about as much water for one glass of water. And this has haunted me ever since. I don't, like, I'm fairly, like, I know at good bars, and at bars are meant to be giving you free water, and like here there is a nice tap which you can get some free water from. This place seems like it's very reluctant to give you any water. Like, it's like, you can have one glass, and it's not going to be right. You're going to have to take a few steps to get it. And I don't think they have an obligation to give you free water at a bottle shop. So they're doing this for some reason, but I'm not sure if they had a, like, if they read the alcohol, like, licensing and, like, accidentally read the on-license one, like, we have to give away free water, and they're like, well, we can't give away too much, because otherwise, why would they ever buy anything else? And the fact that they've given so much space, like, nothing else is on this table. It's just, and they printed off the sign and put it in one of those sign holders. So, on my website, you can click a little star up the top and that will bookmark the website. And you can go back and you can read, like, there's a page called Writing, which has a whole lot of stuff that I've written. There's a link to buy the book, but you can actually also buy it here today. You can click Reviews, which has lots of people saying nice things about my book. There's a page that says Comedy, which I feel like I haven't filled all of those sections out properly, so I think some of them just have random text that WordPress provided. But there's some stuff there. There's a link to RNZ, where somebody read out my parts of my book once, So yeah, there's all that's my gift for you for free. As well as that's all I've come to say.
This is a fire engine. I'm making conversation about scrambled tofu while the fire engine leaves. Please leave. Oh wow. Doesn't even register as high as your voice. These microphones are amazing. You all bought me these microphones. The MI class bought these microphones, so that's good. They're still going strong. Right, okay, I'm ready to start. Are you ready to start?
Yep.
Okay. Hi Eamon, how are you?
Hi Pip. Good. How are you?
Very good. Very hot.
Yeah, it's quite sticky today.
Yeah. I thought the apocalypse would be like bright, clear heat.
I think that would be too nice for the apocalypse. Or go to Christchurch. They do that bright, dry heat.
I love that. Yeah, I just feel like I'm going to end up in a... Yeah, it's so hot. But thank you for coming, and I'll try not to talk about the weather anymore. I was wondering if we could begin by you introducing yourself, however you want to introduce yourself.
Yep. Kia ora, I'm Eamon. I'm, I guess, mostly known as a writer, but have done comedy and theatre and various other things as well.
Yeah. And you're Wellington based at the moment, eh?
Yep. I've been here for basically 11 years now, but with a very small stop in Nelson for a bit.
Nice. Oh, that's so nice. Thank you so much for coming up. And thanks heaps, again, for participating in the Verb After Hours. It was a dream having you at that. It was so great. Thank you so much. And thanks heaps for agreeing to talk about the thing that you did. And I just wondered, this has all got quite meta, because what I'm asking you to do now is describe the object. Now, it can either be the thing that you found funny, or it can be the performance as a whole. So, yeah, if you could just describe something about it. People will have just listened to it. So, yeah, you don't have to go too far into it.
Okay. I brought in a photo I took from a bottle shop that had that was a sign that said free glass of water available, and then there was a single glass and a carafe with a coaster on top with enough water for a single glass of water, and there didn't seem to be any reason for them to have that there, so I found that very funny. And I went back several times to, like, over the course of a couple of weeks, and it was always still there. And then eventually I took a photo of it, and I'm glad I did. And then I listened back to the performance earlier today, and I was kind of surprised about how little I talked about that that thing, because I think I had a whole lot in my head that I had planned to say about it, but I kind of got caught up in this sort of device I used to talk about it. Which I kept on adding to, and then didn't actually talk about the object as much as I remembered that I did. But I think we also did that Q&A afterwards, where I probably said a few other things.
Mm. Yeah, because I think that was one of the things that I really loved about it, is that it... I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll try not to get ahead of myself. You describe in there about coming across this, and you've just described now about going back over and over again. And I just wonder, I don't think I've prepped you for this, so just say, I don't answer it. But I wonder how much of that sort of origin story, how did you work out what was important for people to know about how you came across it, like for the joke? Like, do you think it was important? Yeah, like there's not a huge, I'm not even sure you say which city it's in, but yeah, I just wonder about how you decided that discovery of this object was important to the story.
I think for me the thing that makes it, I think just looking at it, it's funny. I don't think there needs to be an explanation, but I think the fact that it was there for quite a long time is... What I found really funny about it. So, like, if you stumble across it one day, it's like there could have been an event here last night that they haven't quite packed up, or something like that. But the fact it seems like it was an intentional setup, and it always had that amount of water in it. So, I assume that no one ever took them up on that offer of a free glass of water, because it was always one glass one glass worth of water. So I don't know what the, like that's the thing is it's like it's really baffling. I remember coming into it, I had this phrase in my head about how I was going to describe it, and then when I listened to the recording, I started saying this phrase. And then I went off in another direction by the end of it, which was like somebody doing something or seeming so reluctant to do something that nobody asked them to do. Like, yeah.
Because, sorry, I'm just going to choke in my laughter. One of the things, just with you retelling it now, that hadn't hit me is that this was a bottle store. It wasn't even sort of a host responsibility thing, eh?
No, it wasn't host responsibility at all. and it could have been a misreading of the legislation about it and then thinking that they had to provide it. It could have been like a genuine generosity thing, like it's a hot day, we should make sure that people have water and it stayed out there. Because possibly there were other glasses, there was more water, and then once it got down to that level where it looked like it was only ever one, that's when people stopped drinking it. So it could have been all of these things, but it's like we don't know why it is. And before I decided to talk about it, I did question to myself of like, which I do when I'm joking about anything, but like, is this an okay thing to joke about? Am I making fun of somebody who isn't doing anything wrong? And yes, I think I am, but also they weren't doing anything wrong either. It was like there was nothing nefarious about it. It was just a strange thing. It's like if every shop started doing that, it would be fine. It'd probably be good.
Because that's, I mean, I keep coming back to this word, and I never use it properly, but I keep thinking of this word absurd, you know, something sort of in the wrong place, or sort of being used incorrectly, or something, yeah, and I just kept thinking about how in our lives we pass all these really absurd things, but the minute we stop and pay attention to them, they become really funny.
Yeah, I think this is genuinely absurd. I think, and it maybe is one of the few things that's absurd, just by looking at it and unintentionally, which makes it more absurd. Because as soon as something is absurd to make it funny, then it's not really absurd because it has a purpose of having a joke. But this is one of those things which is like feels really. Yeah, just strange.
Sorry, I always say this, but I think you might have just blown my mind. Because I just realised that thing that absurd with purpose is a lot harder to be funny, isn't it? You know, like,
yeah.
I was just, yeah, like, there always needs to be a way of making the absurdity look like a mistake in some ways, I guess. Like, I'm obsessed. No, everyone I talk to, it's very annoying when I've seen something. But, I talked to Gabby about it as well. There's this Kate Berland special, and like the absurdity in it is just feels awkward and strange. And I think that's where the laughter comes from. And I just wonder about that. This, I mean, one of the things that I think is the funniest about this, and on the recording, I can sort of hear myself just in hysterics in the background, is the fact that this is a visual joke and we could not supply anything. Like you said, you very reasonably asked if there could be a projector and there was not one. And I just wonder, I don't know, like that misfortune, did that help? How did you work out how you were going to work around it? Yeah, that kind of thing.
Well, I think you also printed a poster of it, or printed an A3, A2?
It was tiny.
It was, well, it's like reasonably big for a poster, but then in a room it looked small. And yeah, being Meow, which is quite a large room, I think if it was at a smaller venue, that would have just been fine. And we could have also printed it larger, but it was already quite a grainy photo because it was one that I like took very quickly, and then it went into Google Photos, which shrinks everything, and then was printed out. So yeah, I put it on my website, which was the first time I'd really used my website for like maybe 2 years. I hadn't updated it for a long time. And I think it was not long after I had to pay the like $80 or whatever it is to keep it going. And every time that fee comes up, I always think like, oh, is this worth it?
Yeah.
And I think it is to have a website, like, but it was, I think because it happened around that time, that's when I had the idea of putting it up there and then using it, trying to use this thing as a self-promotion tool.
Because it's even, like, I mean, it's that thing as well. One of the things that I really found interesting is that I feel like there are some performances where we pretend some kind of technology doesn't exist, you know what I mean? We're like, everybody, stay off your phones. But there was just something so great about, sorry, I know that things become less funny when I do this to them, but even the fact that your name isn't the easiest to spell, like the URL itself was quite a difficult thing to spell, eh?
Yeah, which I hadn't really considered until because usually you go to websites because of links, like nobody types in a website URL anymore. You go to the websites that you go to every day and then you click on links. So I'd never really considered how difficult my name is to spell. Like, I have to deal, every time I go to the pharmacy, I have to deal with that because I always tell them what my name is and then they walk away and they come back and they say they can't find it and then I have to spell it out for them. And sometimes I try and stop them before they go to spell it out for them. But it's, and it happens all the time. But yeah, I think it was only when I was on stage that I really realized that, that I couldn't just send everyone to amonmara.com and for them to instinctively put it in.
This I've been thinking a lot over the last 24 hours about, like, I have this dumb question next, which is simply, do you have any idea how you do this? And I was wondering, I'm going to throw you a curveball. You can either answer that question, but I was also thinking, like, because you make music as well and you understand music, like, you write about music, you know music, I wondered if there's something to do with rhythm and comedy, like that. Like, it just seemed to watch you do that from where I was sitting, which was like not as part of the audience, it was behind there. It just looked like this absolute amazing, magical, you know, to know when, I don't know, like it was almost like, that's why I keep going to this idea of rhythm or melody, just this idea of knowing. Do you have any idea how you do it, or do you think
I think a little bit. So I like to stand-up comedy, there is a craft to it, which, because I did stand-up for a long time, and still like a very occasionally do it, and I kind of treated this like a stand-up set in a way, and there is kind of a craft to rhythm and kind of knowing how you're performing something, but it is also like the craft is instinctive, it's not it's very hard to teach. I know that I have in the past taught stand-up comedy as a job to high schoolers, and because the craft, the rhythm isn't the same for everyone, it's so dependent on your persona. I think there's a few sort of stand-up tools, like the joke of threes, where you say one of something, two of something, and three of a different thing but still fits in that first category, and that's a rhythm, and that's something you can teach. But I think there's so many other things that can work in structurally within comedy that's more than that, that's more than callbacks. And I think a lot of that is to do with persona and things like that. I think soon after I started doing comedy, I got knocked out of the Raw Comedy Quest in the first round, and I was it was interesting because I listened to the podcast with Gabby, and she talked about this thing about she thought that you had to write a new set every time you performed, and I also thought that, and I'd been doing quite well at comedy, but I hadn't been reusing jokes because I didn't really realize that was a thing you could do. And then I went and I performed at this Raw Quest with a brand new set, and I was first, and then I watched everyone else do jokes that I'd seen them do before, And I was like, oh, this is a insult to comedy that they would that they would do this, and they should be artists and they should be coming up with new material, and that's very important to do as artists. And hadn't really thought that, you know, art isn't just about generating, it's about refining. And soon after that I had a meeting with James Nikise, which he was really nice to do because he was, you know, big comedian on the scene at the time, and I was very new, and I think I talked about this, and he was like, well, you've got, like, you have to work on craft, like, you might have good ideas, but you have to keep working on things and refining them and making it, yeah, which is interesting, because this set that we did, that was the first time I'd done it, because it was a thing written for that event, so I didn't have time to refine things, and I didn't write it down beforehand. I had sort of a list of ideas, and I think I'd done some practicing in my head of what I was going to say, but clearly I actually forgot a whole lot of things because I didn't say them in that recording. That in my head I was like, I thought it was funnier than this. I thought I did better than this.
Oh
yeah.
Oh no, I thought it was great. That's this idea of this is a weird question that comes from my misunderstanding, but I wonder if part of this refinement means that you can perhaps be more not improvisational and like improvisation, but like I wonder if like this honing of the craft is kind of honing a voice in some way or something like that. Do you think there's something to be said about that? Like I was really interested in what you said about persona, because especially with your other work, you know, like if you think about your book, if you think about like the shows that I've seen you do, I hope I'm saying this the right way, but there's a version of you that's there. It's not like you go out and say you're Jim Brown or you're, yeah, I don't know, someone completely different. And I just wonder around that idea of persona, if you've got any thoughts about that, really.
Yeah, I think it is something that you like kind of develop and you craft it, but it is also something that's kind of innate to you. And when I started doing stand-up, it was so much based around anxiety.
Mm.
And that was because I had very bad anxiety and I couldn't hide that anxiety on stage, so I really leaned into it. And then after a while, you know, I wasn't so anxious on stage, and I think that anxiety still is there. But it's, I think there's also this, I think I like to show that I'm enjoying doing it now, and I feel more confident with it, and I like the act of live performance, and I think that all comes out. I like being in front of an audience, and I think that all kind of comes out and merges into this version of myself that I have, which is like somewhat crafted, but somewhat is just what happens to me when I'm put in that position. I find sometimes that version of myself, it does come out sometimes when I'm kind of around a group of friends, when I like find myself being very like performy and doing lots of jokes and kind of getting higher energy and like sort of rolling with that thing. And this sort of version of myself does sort of come out naturally. So I think it has been developed, but it's more a finding than a creating.
I just like I'm quite obsessed with the idea of just having sort of over the last few years having been really privileged to work with people that are doing kind of, I don't even know what we call it anymore, but sort of life writing or writing from experience or those kind of things, and personal experience, lived experience. And I just feel like the writing world has so much to learn from that side of comedy, if you know what I mean. Like this idea of the relationship of the performer to the performance kind of stuff, and also just around, you know, decisions about that stuff you were talking about what to make jokes about, you know, and like how to approach, you know, maybe the low-hanging fruit isn't the best way to go kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because stand-up is both really broad and really kind of specific. You're in such a specific state when you're doing it. If you're doing a sort of lineup show, you don't have much control of who the audience is and what the vibe in the room is and all of these types of things. So you just have to bring whatever you have into that environment. But I think comedy has a bit of a privilege over writing in a way that, because it's this idea of like it's a joke or it's jokes, there's an expectation that any story is going to be heightened to make it work on stage, and you don't explicitly say, unless you do, which is part of the act, like everything I'm telling you is true. But it is also, people do at the same time suspend their disbelief to believe it as true so that they can enjoy the story. But I think it's hard with writing, because the first way it's categorized is fiction or non-fiction. And people will come to that reading with one of those things. It's like the people generally aren't as invested in fictional stories, but non-fiction, they also come into it believing that it's true. It's not this heightened story that you've made up. So yeah, I think stand-up has an advantage in a way.
It's an incredible idea. Like, I mean, it's really profound what you're saying, because it is around that contract kind of way. Like, and I do think you're right. I think that genre definition in writing, that, and I think people equate fiction with true, and I mean fiction with not true, and you know, nonfiction with true, and there's this odd, which I think is why I so love your work and the work of so many other people, where and you may not describe it this way, but I'm always interested in that shimmer that happens when it's, you know, it's true but it's not, you know, it's true but it's not true, if you know what I mean. I don't know, like, I just find it really, really interesting. I always talk about this whenever we're together, but that story, the title story of your book with the bees, you know, like, and I just remember being in that workshop. It's one of the most profound things that's ever happened to me, and everybody saying, oh no, the bees must have happened, they must have happened, and that was, they felt so true. And yeah, I don't know, I just think you're an amazing writer.
Yeah, and I think like a lot of things, it's like they kind of but not really. And I agree that I think that space between fiction and non-fiction is like some of the most fun place to play when you're writing. Like, I'm thinking of this, some books where, you know, it's a fiction book but it starts with everything I'm telling you is true. I think The Life of Pi starts with that. And I read that when I was a teenager and like believed it, I think, up until the island where the trees eat people or something like that. I think it was up until that, which I like. Also, I read it when I was overseas, and it was in an English section of the library, which just had all the books in English, so it wasn't actually wasn't put in a fiction or a non-fiction category. So I think, yeah, it is fun to play in that space. And I think like a lot of people ask or assume about how true my book is, and there isn't really an easy way to say it, because it's all fiction. Just some of the things also happen to me.
Because this is, I think this is why, I mean, like, I've been doing this podcast for a long time and I feel like I've got nothing original to say, but I think this is why I'm so jealous of poetry. Like, poetry seems to be allowed to live in this space where it borrows, you know, it borrows secondary sources, it, you know, like, remixes, you know, things that are somewhere else. Although I do think people often come to a poem thinking that it's autobiographical, but I do think that, and that's what makes me excited at the moment, because I feel like there's more and more fiction, in inverted commas, books that are playing more with that divide.
Yeah, I think it is an interesting space, and I think poetry is allowed to do that by form a bit more.
Yeah.
But it is, I've been thinking a lot about art and media and things like that in general, because the way people talk about art now is, I get quite annoyed about it, about like, this means this thing specifically, and like that becomes canonical because the writer said it was in an interview, or because this other piece of media, which is in the same universe, said this, which is like talking about the Marvel universe. But I find the idea of canon in there really like funny and dumb, because it's like suddenly it's like, oh, this thing that was said in this film has this massive implication for that. It's like, well, it doesn't have to. You're allowed to live with it being true when it's here and it being not true when it's there or whatever. But I think some people like that, but I find it's like dumb question, but like, what is the purpose of art? And I think it's about ideas that can't be said directly, like, about things, and that's not just about making art, it's about consuming art or media as well. It's like things that can't be said directly, and that's even true of non-fiction, it's true of anything. It's like, what's the purpose of making these connections between things? It's because that connection is where the interesting part is, but you can't say that connection without saying these other things.
Which I think is, I don't know, like, again, because I don't fully understand the form, but just like, that's what I think is so interesting about that laugh in comedy, is often that is the thing that's, you know, it can't be said, so instead it's a outburst of this weird noise, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think that is what, when the best comedy is, it's when people make a connection between two things you say. Which is like, that's that joke format of like the rule of threes. That's exactly what that is. It's like 1, 2, 3. Like, the joke isn't three. The joke is connecting 3 to 1 and 2.
Yeah, yeah. Which I think is such an interesting thing as well, because it allows, you know, like again, one of my phrases that I've been saying for ages is that, you know, comedy is cultural, you know, like you have to have a shared culture. But I do think this idea of 1, 2, and 3 allows the person to, you know, build that connection however they want to build that connection, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, which is like, that's why I think, well, that's also why poetry is cool, and why saying what artwork means exactly is canonical is dumb, because it's like, that loses that connection, or it makes that connection for you. It sets that connection in stone, and if you don't interpret it this way, you've done a wrong interpretation, and then that's just like, it makes art dull. But it also is really easy to consume art that way, or consume media that way. So, like, I think you sometimes have to actively work out how to get away from that.
Because I do think I really, well, what I'm doing in my brain is thinking about that horrendous kind of deep mythology where the, you know, like, sorry, I'm thinking of the Marvel Universe because I'm thinking a lot about superheroes at the moment, but like that idea where all I'm watching for is the deep, like, I know, kind of, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh, there's so-and-so, that's because, and, you know, like, And I just find, I think that any spontaneity kind of, it's a different watch.
Yeah, and like, I genuinely enjoy Marvel films.
Oh, yes,
and
it's me
like,
also.
And like, I'm trying to actively watch more interesting films now, because, like, that's kind of something I'm trying to do, because I do find myself just watching those ones again and again, and then also, like, you know, reading up what they mean afterwards and things, and it is kind of, I enjoy that, but it's, I also just find myself getting frustrated when it suddenly gets into really specific readings of things or really specific meanings. And I think the films are made to be read that way as and it's like, part of me just wants them to, like, put out a film which is just as like dumb as everything else, but that completely contradicts everything else and like not, or like gets a whole lot wrong that's been existing in the universe, and watch how the fans have to deal with, you know, this character suddenly like being completely different and completely. But then the thing is they can't do that now because they've put the multiverse out
and
now everything is explained by the multiverse.
Because this is the thing that attracted me to comics, like superhero comics, more than anything, is this idea that, you know, this idea of retconning, this idea that Robin can die and we get another Robin, that Batman can suddenly be this way. And I think that's why I'm finding it really, like, I'm the only person in the world who thinks that Batman versus Superman is the greatest movie ever made. But, like, this stuff that's going on in that universe at the moment, like in DC, about are we going to have the Robert Pattinson Batman? Are we going to... Like, that stuff, one of my favourite things that used to happen when I was a kid, I used to have to watch a lot of... I didn't have to. My grandmother really liked Days of Our Lives, and in those soap operas, often they would replace the actors, and there would just be a little thing under the bottom saying... the part of this person, Roman, will now be paid by, you know, and I love this idea of the artificiality, but it just, yeah, I don't know, like it does feel like a crystal box at the moment, like just, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah, and it's so culturally dominant as well.
Yeah,
that's the other thing, which
is
like, I feel ashamed about enjoying it and investing quite a lot into it because it's like every time I invest more energy into this Disney-owned billion-dollar, like billion-dollar, each movie is a billion-dollar movie, like into that, it's like I could be putting my energy into actually genuinely interesting things, but this, it's sort of an addiction.
I feel exactly the same way. Like I always, after every time I walk out of the cinema, I'm like, that's the last one. And that's the other thing is that they're movies that I will go and see in the cinema. You know,
yeah,
like,
they're fun in the cinema. I'm going to join the Film Society this year, which is going to make me go to the cinema to see the other type of film, which I think is good to watch in the cinema, which is films which, if I watch them at home, I'll end up getting my phone out.
Yeah, so like,
So it's like forcing you to watch a bit more slowly or to like allow yourself to like have to work for it.
And
Rather than doing Sudoku.
I love Sudoku. And that, I think that's interesting structurally as well, is like that whole literacy that I don't have, like that visual literacy. We were watching something the other day. Oh, I think, God, I feel like I've had this conversation with you before, but something took so long. Like they walked into the room, they walked into the kitchen, they walked over, you know what I mean? Like it was just this very long tracking shot. And it was just like, I cannot quite compute with this. And it made me really excited. Like, it was suddenly like, this is a different visual language that I'm not used to.
Yeah, I think film is the sort of media that I feel the least confident with in that way. I think I'm not that visual a person, and I have quite a lot of patience for music.
Yeah.
I think any reading requires a bit of patience. Mm-hmm. I'm working on my patience with reading. It comes and goes. I can't believe, like, I just actually got 2 Don DeLillo books that I found from a community library, and it's like, cool. And then I opened it up, and like, how did I read Underworld?
Yeah.
When I was
like
22 years old.
Yeah.
It's like 900 pages backwards plot.
Yeah.
In this style. Because I used to be able to have patience with books like that, but working on that.
Yeah, I'm in a very similar space, like where I'm just like, I want to fix my attention. Like I really want, it is broken and I want to fix it. One of the things that I think is interesting in this idea of attention and time and patience and that is your blog is friggin' amazing. We are writing about each one of the albums that you own, and I've found that, you know, like, I love reading it, and I just wonder how you started doing that.
This is quite interesting because it's like, it's, do you know when you start writing a project or doing a project and suddenly every single other part of your life seems to feed into it and you've got all these ideas?
Cool.
It feels like a bit like that because I think it's a bit about attention in multiple ways. So one of it is like, I did a similar project a few years ago, but it was just on Instagram. I got Instagram, didn't know how to use it because I'm not a visual person. I found the idea of putting an image out there to communicate anything very difficult. So I listened to every record I owned, and I wasn't allowed to skip them until I had listened, and I wasn't allowed to repeat a record until I'd listened to them all and took a photo of them all when I did it. And it took a few months, but over the last year or so I've had a more stable income and find myself spending lots of money on records. And I really like owning records for another reason, which I'll go into in a bit, but it was like, part of it was like, I need to actually start appreciating these ones rather than just keeping on collecting them and keeping on collecting them. And writing about music makes you listen to it carefully. It makes you like assess how it makes you feel. I think about where I got it, what, like when I really started liking this artist, or how I got to like it, and that kind of thing, which I really like. I also like writing about music, like writing about music. My favorite thing on the internet is the number ones column by Tom Brehan, I think it's how you say his name, is on Stereo Gum, where he's reviewing every number one single from the US and up to 2007 at the moment, I think, and it's been going for about 4 years, and I love it so much. And I've just read his book, and I also read Needles and Plastic last year, and This Band Can Be Your Life. So I really like reading about music, and so it was also like an exercise to make me write more often because I was stagnating with fiction projects that I was on and finding it really difficult. So just like short, sharp, quick things to get me doing that. So all of that stuff. But the reason I did it on, so I've been considering doing it for a long time, and I'd always kind of thought about going back to Instagram to do it. But the reason I put it off is I'm getting really cynical about social media, and especially about algorithm driven social media and streaming websites. I now hate Spotify, and I use Tidal, and Tidal has a terrible algorithm, so it never feeds you anything you like, which is good, so it stops me using it. But doing it on my own website, on a blog, which kind of goes back to me paying for this thing last year and thinking, what am I using this for? It means that none of this content will be fed into this thing and then thrown at people next to other content which has nothing to do with it. It stops becoming something that was written by me and starts becoming something that was written by, like, by someone on Instagram. Or like, how often do you see a tweet and you think, that's, I saw a funny tweet today, but you don't know who wrote it, you don't know what context it was in. And also that kind of goes back to Sam doing the thing where everything feeds into each other, but the idea of when we're talking about how all art kind of is about this, the connections that are made between two things, it's those connections are now being made, they're being placed next to each other by an AI or a robot or possibly a person. It's so opaque, we've got no idea how it works, and I think that's driving some of this conspiracies and things like that. It's like, because we're this machine is putting two things next to each other, and people are drawing connections or conclusions between the two of them, which is created by or being pushed by or is accidental but is destroying the world or is intentional in destroying the world. But I want to get out of that system. I don't want to feed into that system. And also the other thing about writing about every record I own is I don't think it has an audience. It's got a few people will like it, but it's not going to get a big audience. And like, I find work that I make that I think could be enjoyed by a lot of people if they gave it a chance, that is like soul destroying at the moment, because within these systems that we have set up, it doesn't really have a chance, or it has a very small chance, but it has to break through this huge system which you have no control over. So it's quite nice writing something that has no, that, like, I don't care if lots of people read.
Man, I love everything you've said, because, like, I think that I feel the soul destroying, crushing, yeah, and I just, like, am so interested in how to bring these back to small, do you know what I mean? Like, just bring these back to, like, something that I would find enjoyable as far as writing goes, and that just, yeah, I just love it. How did you, are they in alphabetical order? I can't, no. So how do you decide the order of them? Talking about algorithms and how they sit next to each other.
That's what I feel like listening to and find so at good. The time.
Yeah.
Like, I have got, I wanted to release a post every day.
Yeah.
But I haven't done one since Saturday or something. And it's because I've got three posts sitting there almost finished that have become so much more, like, bigger than,
yeah,
because some of the early ones are like 300 words or 200 words or something, and it hasn't got much information. And now I've got these three ones which are all, like, very, they, by listening closely to them, they all brought up really intense personal things, and I want to be a bit more careful about what intense personal things I put out on into the world, because I've done a lot of that and I don't always think that that's been good for me.
Mm.
So it did pretty quickly move from something that was easy to write, could throw it out there, to something which is like, oh, I actually need to work on this. Yeah, so hopefully those will be done over this weekend. They're Slint Spiderland, Stella Donnelly's Beware of the Dogs, and the latest album from Low, Hey What,
oh, yes,
which are all amazing albums,
yeah,
and all are quite different. But yeah, it's funny that happened so fast. I wasn't expecting it.
Mm.
And so it has slowed down the project a bit, but I think that's okay. Hopefully I'll pick up another thing and just be like, oh, the drums sound cool on this one.
I think this is one of the things that was hard for me to learn, like, because any project I'm doing, I always need rules. Like, I'm just like, right, you know, and this idea that something can organically change, the rules can change, if you know what I mean. And I think that is a huge part of what makes a project like that so great, is that, because I was just thinking, like, anything I've tried to do every day like that, I've always had to find a different way, you know, it very quickly becomes way more, I don't even know what the word is, way more sort of, it's almost like physical exercise, you know, you find yourself running further and able to be fitter, and yeah, I don't know, like, that's what I've found with stuff like that, which I just think is so great.
Yeah, when I say every day, what has happened is on a Sunday I've sat down and listened to music for 6 hours and written up five posts and queued them all up, and then sometimes I'll do another one during the week nights. But it's not a hard rule, but it is it is something that I'm trying to do more regular things.
And, like, just thinking about that stuff you were saying about, like, that balance between structure and freedom, you know, when you were talking about, like, the things that can be taught and the things that can't be taught, I don't know, it just seems like such a great, I don't know, I'm loving it. I will always, and it's really nice because I've got some of the albums, so, like, I'm finding, one of the best things we did, I think, is buy a turntable last year, and, yeah, like, I just, the listening experience is so different, like, even the physical thing of having to get up and swap it over and listening, like, I just, on any of those streaming services, like, although I do really enjoy Bandcamp, like, I tend to listen to a whole album on Bandcamp, but, like, I just found myself, you know, I'd listen to one song, I'd be like, oh, I don't know if I like this one, and yeah, whereas, like, with the Vine or with the albums, it feels like, oh, I'm not going to get up and cue it up, you know, like,
yeah,
it's just, I don't know, I really love it.
Yeah, I'm, because it is so much money.
Yeah.
But I think not... This is also, like, about the value of art itself. Because it's funny thing. It's like, as an access to that artwork, it's a lot of money because you can get that for a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
But as, like, what value we're getting out of this work, and I feel like it isn't unreasonable saying someone with a, you know, stable income and no dependents and things like that. But I think, like, it's okay to spend $40-$50 on something that you really like, that a lot of work has gone into. I feel the same thing about buying books. Like, we can have access to it in the library. You can get it for you can get books for 99 cents on Kindle. You can pick them up secondhand. You can do book swaps. But I also think, like, it's fine to go and spend $30 on a book and you don't have to think, oh, I could get this cheaper somewhere else. It's like maybe this is very, like, a capitalist view on it, but it's like you're putting money into this system which creates this thing, which is, you know, not always a good system in terms of record labels and some publishers and things. But I think it's okay to put value into that. But I think my favourite thing about owning records and having collected them for like 12 years, starting off very sporadically buying them and now buying them far too often, but it means that, like, an album that I, you know, got really into for 3 weeks in 2015, once a year or so, I'll find it and be like, oh, I'll listen to this, and then have that same feeling again. And I haven't ever had an album that I've, like, saved on Spotify, stopped listening to, and come back and be like, oh, what's this? Like, it's possible, but I just don't ever have that same experience. And yeah,
I totally agree. Like, I think, I totally agree. Like, and sort of it comes back to some of the stuff you were talking about before, like that idea of virtual space and physical space. There's just, you know, like, I walk past them every day. I flick through them to find the one that I want. And like you say, like, I really relate to that. I really relate to it. And just, I mean, I don't know, like, I spent years stealing music, and then I spent years, you know, like, on Spotify. But, like, yeah, like, last year we bought an album, and the person that made the album came and dropped it off. And I just suddenly, it was quite a big wake-up call for me. I was suddenly like, you know, there are humans. Yeah, I don't know, like, oh God, I sound like a terrible person.
Like, when I was 18, 19, and was almost all the music I listened to, I was stealing.
Yeah.
I was still spending more on music than I would if I was just paying for Spotify.
Yeah.
Like, I was putting more, and the money that I was spending on music was going into either local CD stores or directly from bands or things like that. And it's like, it's funny because I guess people often have this idea of like, oh, because it's a legal thing or because it's a thing, it's fine and we should. But it's like, I think the way that I was doing it then of stealing most music but still spending $20 a month or $30 a month on things that I like, I think that is still a more ethical way of consuming music than just putting on a playlist that Spotify makes for you.
Yeah.
And I, like, not just about the money you put in, because it's not all about money, but I think actively choosing music is a good thing, and more people should do it, and playlists that are automatically generated, or that I've been trying to tell everyone just turn off their, like, continue playing after this album's finished function, and Bluetooth speakers are terrible. They need to be stopped.
It's so true. Oh my gosh, I like this.
This is just like everything that I rant about all the time has come out now. But yeah,
thank you for ranting, because I do think it's so interesting, because just the stuff you're saying about I don't know, I could talk for hours, but just that idea of an algorithm deciding what I see next, and, you know, like, an algorithm, and I'd never thought about it before, but that idea of the connections are being made by something else. And yeah, I don't know, I'm really in a phase of trying to slow down a little bit at the moment.
There's an article on Stereo Gum. It was something that I was, like, wondering about for a long time, and then I found this article about it, about the song Harness Your Hopes by Pavement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that is the number one Pavement song on Spotify. And it's a B-side from, like, the Brighton, the Corner session. Wasn't on a proper album. It ended up on the bonus edition and somehow shot up to number one.
Mm.
And I find that, like, to the top, to their most played song. And then after it shot up to the most played song, it's, like, there is, has been, like, TikToks made on it, and it's the cover, and they made a music video, and it's, and most of the media about it has treated it as if that was an organic thing that happened, that people discovered that song, and then it became a fan favourite, and it's like, no, like, when was the last time you went into the bonus tracks of the extended edition of an album, found a song, and just started playing that, and then if everyone did that, it's like, I think it's a good song and it could be on that album, but that was something which happened because, and turns out it happened in 2018, which there's a Galaxy 500 song which also shot up to their top song then, and a few other bands, and it's like, it turns out that I think, like, something about that song, like its tempo or its key or structure, just ticked the box of, like, the most Pavement-y song, and then started getting added to playlists as, like, oh, this person listens to, I don't know, like, REM or something, like, maybe they'll like Pavement, and then listen to the song, and it's like, maybe it's good that the song had a second chance at finding fans or finding things, because it is a good song, but I find it just creepy that, and that people have made it, like, talk about these things as if it's a success story, or it's an organic thing, and it's like, it's really, I find it really creepy.
I also find it creepy. Like, I just, because I think, as well as everything that you're saying, the idea that maybe this is being puritanical, but just the idea that those things you're saying about tempo and, you know, everything just becomes on, off.
Well, when everything
ones
kind of
and zeros, you know what I mean? Like,
it drives everything to be the same. Have you ever been on an Air New Zealand plane and heard the songs that it sounds like?
Yes.
And they all sound like a sort of mix between Benny and Lord. None of them are bad, but it does, there's just this sort of, this type of music that has become, like, and it's played on Air New Zealand, but it's also, like, if you go and look up those artists on Spotify, they've got tens of thousands of listens or whatever, but it's like, it doesn't feel like a genuine way of reaching fans if it's just like, you're making a song which fits into the right criteria to get added to a playlist that people in New Zealand will get fed after they finish listening to Benny.
Oh my god, it's blowing my mind. Because it just, I must admit, like, I, the other day I was listening to something. There's an Ed Sheeran song that goes, You've Found Love Right Where You Are, or something like that. And I realized that I've always said that's one of my favorite songs, and I always hear it in the supermarket. And I just suddenly realized that it just slipped in with such ease. Like, there's something about, like, the first time I heard that song, it was almost like that monkey brain kind of, oh, I know what's going to happen next, and it fulfills it, and I know what's going to happen next, and it fulfills it. And I think that's another reason that I've been so interested in comedy this year, is that it feels like comedy absolutely relies on not doing the next thing.
Yeah, it's like, it's, that is right, it's like, it's totally about subverting expectations, and it's a whole lot of media is just designed to be able to, like, like, I fall into the habit of watching Instagram Reels, which is, you know, TikTok for millennials. But it's just like, you can just keep scrolling and it keeps showing up, and there's very rarely anything that you find yourself in this strange space where it's like 80% of things are like all right.
Yeah, yeah.
And totally watchable and totally at
the
end. You keep going and it's like, yeah, you find lots of good videos of dogs, but being more intentional about what you're consuming is good. And so I need to stop doing it. But it's so easy, and you know, when you're tired, and it's easy to do that, or easy to watch a Marvel film, or easy to listen to a Spotify playlist, or easy to read the new Sally Rooney book, which all of those things are totally enjoyable. I also think Sally Rooney has a lot of depth and is yep. really enjoyable to read, but it's like just picking up the thing that is being fed to you that everyone else is doing, and then reading it. I found after that Sally Rooney book came out, there were not actually very many interesting conversations about it.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
just that everyone had read it, and it was all like, who was your favourite character? And you had to work to make it interesting.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I do, I mean, I am kind of, I'm interested in the way that, yeah, like what I'm craving. And I think that making that shift is really hard. And I think, you know, like I say, like, I think, I don't know, like, yeah, I just think that sometimes, it frightens me, because sometimes I'll get to 10 o'clock at night and think I've watched like 9 episodes of Below Deck. Although I do think reality TV is another thing that can work quite well as far as expectations go. But I just, it really surprised me like how much of my time is spent. And it was really great because I've just been reading this book where someone talked about, he's the person that invented that phrase that if you're not paying, you're the product.
Oh, yeah.
But he said, I need to change that, because if you're not paying, you're the labourer. And yeah. I suddenly thought, now that I'm thinking of scrolling as I'm doing work for Instagram so that they can tell what works in their thing, I've been thinking of it differently. I've been thinking, oh yeah, this is work. This is not, you know.
Have you listened to the song Age of Self by Robert Wyatt?
No.
So he's a really interesting guy. I wrote about him on the blog for a song called Shipbuilding. But Age of Self, it's the song from the 80s about how the idea of like being a person is, or like your value as a person has changed from being worker to consumer, and that's destroyed the union movement, but it's like interesting that that idea is still very fresh today, because it's like that idea of if you're not paying, you're the product, that still puts you in the consumer thing, but it's actually like, yeah, you're putting the work you put into that is profiting people who profit off your labor, which is like it's all Marxism.
Yeah, it's all Marxism. I love that. We're getting towards the end. This has been just the most exciting conversation. Thank you. I don't often feel excited about writing, but you've made me feel excited about writing, or art, or whatever it is. Which I did. There are just a couple of three other questions that I wanted to ask you if you've got time.
Yep.
Thank you. One of them is around the fact that you're making music. Well, you made some music for Show Ponies, and I felt very excited about that. And yeah, I don't even know what I want to ask about that. I'm excited. Like, what this idea, this loosening off of form, is of you. I think that what I'm saying is what I want to do is start loosening off form a little bit. Instead of saying I write novels, I quite like the idea that there could be different ways to express a similar consciousness or something. But I just wonder, like, did you love making the music? Did you like?
I like making music, and I've played music for longer than I've done anything else.
Yeah.
But I've never been good or successful at it, and basically the reason I could do it for Chopin is I bought a synthesizer, a thing called a Deluge, which does make it quite easy to create a sort of full song. Like, it's previously it's kind of, I've been playing guitar and I'll play some things, and then you can maybe come up with a melody on top, but then you have to work on a chorus, and you have to kind of work completely differently and work out how to put it together, and I've never been able to quite finish anything that way ever. And I've never been good enough at it to jam with anyone or do anything, so it's always been something I do and hasn't really anything's completed. So getting the Deluge meant that I could start doing those types of things a bit more, but a lot of it was just making something art that, again, it came down to like stagnating on this new novel that I'm working on, where it's just like it became really difficult and kept on getting, like, just getting bummed out by, like, that the audience is so small and that people aren't actually reading, and the people who are reading aren't reading New Zealand books, and the people who are reading New Zealand books aren't necessarily reading books like mine. And it's like became, and then starting to like, oh, I need to write differently to appease these people, and that feeling bad. So doing something which like, there's no expectation that I'm going to be good at this, or I don't have to put it out there, or when I do, it's like I put it on Bandcamp, and like I like it when people listen, but it's not I'm not making it for a wide audience, I guess. But in terms of making things in different forms and stuff, I feel like I've always done that, and that's, I feel like, almost entirely to do with Joseph Harper, who is a person who I met when I was like 16, and he was in a band called Black Market Art, but then he also did these side projects, and then he also did drama and moved up to Auckland and started doing stand-up comedy, and that's why I started doing stand-up comedy. And he made dumb music on the side and wrote fiction and made these really great plays and things, and I think that's like entirely where I got my like, I think all of the stuff I do is just what he does, or he did, and he doesn't do that much anymore, which, you know, maybe out there there's somebody who's saying the same thing about me. It's like, he's not really doing that much anymore because I haven't really publicly been doing anything for a while. But yeah. Oh yeah, he also, the last time I was on this podcast, I brought a song of his on.
I know.
So it's all him.
It's all coming.
I forgot about that until just then. But yeah, it's like,
I was just thinking, oh gosh, this is so great. The circle, time is a circle. I like it a lot.
Yeah, you should get him on.
I know.
The show for some reason.
I really should. If he was willing, I would be. I'm going to hunt him down, the poor person. I think I love this idea of like working out this is probably not what you said, but this idea of working out a problem in one medium and another medium, if you know what I mean, like this idea of coming to a halt in one, and what I would normally do is go, the novel's not working, I'll write a short story, but this idea that the novel's not working, I'll go make some music is a really nice idea.
Yeah, I don't think it's solved any problems, because that's also, that's, but you've the same made some logic music I've done to making the blog.
Yeah,
it's the same logic I've done, and I've also been trying to write short stories, and also nothing has been finished.
But I do, I don't know, I feel grateful that all those things are in the world, and I'm sorry that it's been hard. I've got a craft question that I really wanted to ask you for ages, and it's around the idea of sort of the straight delivery, and do you know what I mean? Like, I don't even know if that's a thing, but when a joke is delivered in a straight way, in a way that the person telling it doesn't seem to think or understand or realize that it's funny. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, that's a comedy technique. I think that it's just, it makes the audience feel smart, I guess, or that they're the funny ones. I think, do you know Ray O'Leary?
I think he's
like the best at doing that.
Yeah.
Where he always seems like he has no idea that what he's saying is funny, but he's so good at it.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, all those, like, sitcoms and things, they all had, like, a straight man character. And I think it's essential to have a bit of that in comedy. It can't all be... No, it can all be wacky.
I'm
looking forward to seeing Hamish Parkinson and David Koryos. And that'll be 100% wacky.
Oh, my
wacky.
God.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's just a... I think it works for me when I can do it, but I don't think it... I'm not as good at doing it as Ray is, I think,
Because that is so true what you just said. Like, it really is a thing where the audience thinks, oh, you know, like, I, ha, ha, ha. And I just suddenly thought of that. And that thing of sort of the straight person kind of amplifies the humour because you're suddenly seeing, you know, they sort of become a stand-in for you kind of stuff. And, yeah, I don't know, I'm very interested in the straight man. Oh, that sounded weird. You know what I mean?
Straight man is sorry, also straight guys. A fascinating topic in terms of why are they like that?
Why are you like that?
Yeah,
that true, and especially in comedy. I want to finish. I always ask people this question, and I haven't quite worked out how to ask it, even though I've been asking it for like over a year. But I'm just wondering what do we need to keep writing? How do we keep going? How do we keep going and doing art? How do we, you know, obviously it's cool to just give up. I'm not saying that. But I just wonder, you know, what is it that we need to keep going?
I saw a tweet about this just before I arrived, which was quoting Nathan Joe,
mm-hmm.
that said when people ask him, what do the arts need for support? And he said, to show up.
Yeah.
Because, like, read a book by a New Zealand author. It could be my book.
It should be your
yeah.
book.
like, just make an effort to listen. And, like, listen to some music from a local band, and that band doesn't have to be The Beths. Like, The Beths are, like, one of my favourite bands in New Zealand, but it's like, if we're all listening to the same five New Zealand bands, we're not, that's not growing a scene.
Mm.
It's, see who The Beths have had support for them on their tours. Listen to them.
Yeah.
Like, and don't be afraid to pay money if you can to things. but I think it's less, I mean, if somebody buys my book, that benefits the bookshop and the publisher in some small way, which is nice. Benefits me, kind of, but not that much. I don't mind if you get it out from the library, you borrow it, but I would. It's better to be read than any amount of money. But also, it's okay to pay for things. You can just because you can get it for cheaper or for free. Sometimes you just do it.
I was just thinking about what an excellent example of this Peaches has been in the last week, you know, like the support for Peaches, you know, like there's Strange Stains, Freya's going to do something, and, you know, I understand that Nathan had something to do with that as well, but just this idea that, I really like that. You know, we can love these bands, but also, yeah, this idea, I think that's been one of the really enjoyable things for me this year. Like, we went and saw Marlon Williams last week, and Womb was playing support, and to see bands that maybe haven't played the Michael Fowler Centre play the Michael Fowler Centre is pretty beautiful.
Yeah. Right?
It's pretty nice.
Well, one of my favourite New Zealand artists, like, maybe my favourite New Zealand artist, opened for Big Thief on their tour.
Oh, yes!
Junke.
My lord!
I have a dream of writing a 33 and a third book about her album Silk.
Oh, please.
Felt. Yeah. But I think she's just, like, the most important musician in New Zealand. Nobody has heard of her. I don't know how she got that slot.
Mm.
And she also, like, did something fully inappropriate for that. I saw them at the Power Station in Auckland.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably even more inappropriate than Michael Fowler Centre.
Definitely.
But it's like sitting down, singing to a backing track, playing a melodica. And it's like, I mean, I think I would rather see her do that at the Pyramid Club. I feel like it would work better. But just that she got to do that and I got to see her perform, because she doesn't perform very often.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, like, all of her albums and love her music so much, and I think she needs to be, like, canonized in the New Zealand literary scene, because I think she does, like, the same things that, like, Jenny Bornholt does.
Yeah.
But it's just, yeah, so good, and yeah, it was amazing seeing that. But it's like, if you go to a big gig, show up for the support act, pay attention to them, don't talk through them.
Yeah.
Don't go out smoking, like, it's fine, it's half an hour of your life, like, you'll get to talk to your friends another time.
Like, I feel ridiculous, like, Big Thief was a great night, but coming into contact with her music was the greatest thing. Like, it was like, the support was announced, we listened to the music, and just everyone in our house is just absolutely converted, and just,
everything you are saying is just so true. Like the literary, I mean, I know that that's like a death knell in any music, but the understanding of words as well as music is just unbelievable.
Well, she does it in a way that isn't, there are some other artists, thinking of like Dunedin artists that talks about being literary, is like Graham Downs from the Verlaines, and I find his stuff kind of like a bit pompous.
Yeah, yeah.
And it feels like it's more about literature than being, and it's like most of Maxine Fonke's songs are about like sewing or going to the secondhand shop or some stuff that she has or like a conversation she has, and they feel just really, feel like it's the, and they're also like home recorded and things. It's like the real merging of that history of Dunedin literature or Dunedin music and the sort of lineage of Catherine Mansfield into contemporary New Zealand literature in this one place. And I also don't, that's a completely different thing, probably not for today, but I don't understand how she keeps getting, like, in this world that we're in with Spotify algorithms and stuff, she's managed to get just records pressed and sold out internationally without having any online presence. How do people discover her music? How does that end up selling out pressings? She's not known here at all. I don't know how that works. So
it just and like even right down to like something about the performance, the way that it was, I suddenly realized that there are decisions that musicians are making about what's on the backing track and what's played live. Like that had never occurred to me before. Like it was just like, how do you decide that the melodica is the thing that needs to be in the foreground? Yeah. I mean, it was just one of the most amazing sort of half hours of my life. And I would have, and I feel stupid that I would have missed it. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, I saw it in Auckland and it wasn't a good, and like people were talking, a friend that I hadn't seen for a long time came up to me and started talking to me, and I was quite, felt like I was quite rude to him by trying to watch it. And then there was also a man collapsed in the crowd, and like people coming and helping him, so it wasn't, I really would like to see her play guitar though, because I think her guitar playing is really beautiful, but she chose not to do that for some reason. I don't know how she usually performs live. I think she was just doing an Australian tour recently, which is, I think one of her labels is in Australia.
I just swear, like, I must admit, like, sorry, I've kept you for way too long, but I must admit that, like, this is so embarrassing. It's just embarrassing. But I did watch, and when I read, I was just like, that is kind of artistic goals, you know what I mean? Like, just this incredibly, I don't know. Like, there's just something, like, I wish I could write a book like she writes music. Like, it was just astounding. Astounding.
She just keeps, she's quite prolific as well. Like, because it's also, she didn't, I did have a CD at one stage from a band she was in the 90s. I can't remember their name, but they were quite different. But her first album, which I think was Lace, came out in like 2016 or something. And she was already, I don't know how old she is, but I think she's in her 40s now. So she's probably in her late 30s at that stage, and it is quite amazing just making stuff of that quality from, you know, reasonably, like, people can start artistic careers at any time, but music is often like a youthful one, and I don't know much about her. I would like to know. That's why I would like to write a book about it.
God, can you please?
Well, there's a 33 and a third. There's now an Oceania 33 and a third series coming out, and I only know about this because Luke Rowell's By Now is being written about as well.
Oh, great.
And, like, that's been a question that I've had with Johnny Potts quite a few times, like, what album would you write about if you got to write one?
Yeah.
And I think before that got announced, I'd settled on, I haven't decided whether it's Felt or Silk, because I like Silk better, but I think Felt fits the themes I want to talk about better.
Oh my gosh.
But they all end up being about lots of things. But I don't know if I don't, like, all the other ones are about, like, men at work and these huge albums. Like, I don't know how many copies Like, I don't know if Bloomsbury would be
one. Yeah. At least me. Yeah. And then I'd buy one for Brent for his birthday. Yeah. And
Johnny would buy one.
Yeah, Johnny would buy. Yeah, there we go. We've got three. My God, it's huge. You'll probably get it on the bestseller list. Thank you so much, Eamon. Thanks. And thank you for the extra time. And thank you for talking about all these amazing things. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.